Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Katie Hannan. Joining me this afternoon, I have Hildegard Nocton, Minister of State with responsibility for international and road transport and logistics. Nasa Horrigan, Green Party Finance and Health spokesperson and chair of the party's policy council. Sinn Féin's spokesperson on finance, Piers Doherty. Professor Alan Irvine, president of the Irish Hospital Consultants Association. Professor Sam McConkie, head of the Department of International Health and Tropical Medicine at RCSI. University of Medicine and Health Sciences and President of the Infectious Disease Society of Ireland, and Senator Michael McDougall, a former Attorney General and former Minister for Justice. Now, today we're going to be talking about the rise in COVID cases, Operation Fanacht, and the plans to introduce the on-the-spot fines for breaching restrictions, and carbon tax and the budget, and we want your input. Would you take a level 5 now if it meant you could have a level 2 Christmas? Would the threat of an on-the-spot fine stop you from crossing a county border? Text us on 51551, email saturday at rte.ie, or tweet to at Saturday RTE. Now, as of this morning, there were 194 patients with COVID-19 in hospital. That's the highest number we've had hospitalised with COVID-19 here since June the 2nd. 31 of those are in ICU. Last night, there were 617 new confirmed cases on this side of the border and 1,080 in Northern Ireland. Sam McConkie, looking at those figures and at where those figures are going, do you think we should be at level 5 now?
Well, I think if we want to get out of this in any comfortable, prompt way, I think we need more restrictions than we have at present. While the level 3 in Dublin is seeing a levelling off of the cases in Dublin, they're still continuing to rise around the country. And my view is just staying where we're at is not really good enough. It's still leading to escalating numbers of hospitalisations, ICU and cases and deaths. We're seeing now about for 600 deaths, we're seeing for 600 cases, we're now seeing 5 or 6 deaths, which is sort of 1 in 100 or 1 in 200. And I don't think going on like this for 3 to 5 years is a good idea. So I think we need to have discussions about
For 3 to 5 years, Sam.
Is that in the medium term, this is a medium term strategy, is not a sensible way, and it's not getting us out of this now. So we need a plan to get out of this. We need some medium term strategic thinking about how we're going to deal with this. And just continuing like this, it's like ongoing purgatory, as I said before.
So you're saying that we could be facing into level 3 type scenario for not just months, but for years.
Exactly. I don't see that as a good solution if that's what people are proposing. And it's not clear that this current situation we're in will fix the problem. This idea of a vaccine by Christmas, we had politicians telling us that everything would be fixed by Christmas a few months ago. Now that suddenly they've gone quiet. There's no one talking now about a vaccine by Christmas. Now we're hearing how long it'll take to roll it out, how long it takes to make 8 billion doses. The vaccine might not be permanently effective, might be temporary, and it might be partial. So this idea of a technical solution that will fix this imminently in the next few months, I don't see it there. So we're going to have to go with one that involves social distancing and physical distancing.
Are you suggesting we need this circuit break, this new term that has entered the COVID lexicon this week, a kind of a shock therapy to break the chains of transmission?
I think that is one way to get us back sort of to where we were in June and July, which was clearly a much better situation. There are other strategic options as well. If we were up for it, we could convert most of the hotel rooms around the airport into observed quarantine facilities. So people flying into our country have to spend 10 or maybe 14 days in observed quarantine, as they're doing in Australia, New Zealand and most of Asia, to stop reintroduction. And then we could potentially get down to zero within our country and let internal domestic activity get back up to normal. That involves, of course, working with the people in Northern Ireland and possibly with Britain as well. The British, may well be up in Scotland. It sounds that they're saying, yes, go for zero COVID. Now, I don't know what the Englander option for at this stage. I don't think they're even clear about it. But I think we need these medium-term strategic discussions at this point.
OK. Michael McDougall, you're no fan of lockdowns.
No, I'm not. I think they are immensely damaging. And I hear what Sam McConkie is saying. But there's a huge price in terms of human life to going to level 5. At the moment, people are dying of cancer unnecessarily. People's heart conditions are not being diagnosed. People are people with strokes are likelihood of having strokes. They are in escalated danger, if I may put it that way, as a result of this. So it's not all one way street. And COVID deaths aren't the only deaths. Nor is public health simply a COVID issue. I mean, public health involves psychiatric issues as well. It involves well-being. The WHO definition of public health involves social well-being. So you're dealing with people, for instance, whose kids, disabled kids have no services. You're dealing with people suffering from domestic abuse at home because if we go to a level five. But much more important than all of this, Katie, is I was speaking the day before yesterday to somebody who was aware of a factory in West Dublin, which is a manufacturing plant. If we went to level five, 300 jobs go, and that factory will never resume its business again because others will take over the supply chain that it's at the moment dealing with. 300 jobs is a very serious matter. And I don't want to emulate the Leo Varadkar and say that, you know, when you're getting the cheque, you should be very careful about planning other people's sacking. But we have to be very, very balanced in our approach to escalating.
But what do we do then? I mean, we can see the way the numbers are going. It's inevitable that we're going to see more hospitalisations. It's inevitable we're going to see more people ventilated in ICUs. It's inevitable we're going to see more people dying. You're suggesting we shouldn't be at level three even.
No, I'm not suggesting we shouldn't be at level three.
What are you suggesting?
Sam didn't come up with any great proposal there. He's suggesting that we should go for a zero infection regime in Ireland. That's not going to happen. It's simply not going to happen. That isn't the plan of the government. It isn't the policy of the government. We are not going to isolate Ireland like New Zealand was able to do. And you know,
but what happens if our ICUs are overwhelmed?
First of all, can I say in relation to that the same people in NPHET are senior officials from the Department of Health and from HSE. They've been warned over the last 10 years that Ireland is dangerously low on ICU beds and they've done nothing about it. And these exact same people are now suggesting that those people in Ballyfermot should lose their jobs. That was the implication of level five. So, I mean, and that business should wrap up. So,
I'm sorry,
I mean,
now.
Okay, Nessa.
I think to lay, you know, the chronic underfunding over decades of our health service at the door of NPHET is really unfair. Those are political decisions. And NPHET aren't politicians and they're not charged with balancing issues around the economy and everything else. They're charged with advising the government in terms of public health. Now, they are doing that to the best of their ability, and it's for the government then to make those decisions. What I would say is, look, we all know what we're talking about here. If we reject the idea or the possibility of lockdown, or even that circuit breaker idea, what we're talking about is then we're into the herd immunity idea. And I mean, there's a real human cost there. You know, my husband is high risk and he's 44 years old. Like, you're talking about people, young people who have their lives in front of them and older people who have their lives in front of them. Those are people that you're saying, well, you know, that's a chance I'm willing to take because we need to keep the economy going or we need to keep factories open.
I mean, I take NASA's point about her husband, but I also make this point that there are people suffering from psychiatric illness at the moment who are not getting any proper treatment. And the second point...
But if our hospitals... Can I just put you, though? Because the logic of where you're going is, if our hospitals are swamped and this second wave comes at us like a tsunami... The psychiatric patients or the cardiac patients or the stroke patients will be abandoned as well.
There is no tsunami and the figures don't back up the notion of a tsunami. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is that whereas NASA says, and she's right in a technical sense, that NPHET is not a political body. Can I make this point? These senior people in the Department of Health, the medical advisor and the person in charge of the whole acute hospital programme, they are members of NPHET. And they are there because they have those positions. So there is culpability about the lack of ICU units. We've had report after report over the last 10 years saying we have to invest in these things and nothing has been done.
Okay, I want to bring in Hildegard Lockton because she's been waiting patiently. Hildegard, just in relation relation to what happened and what unfolded over the last week, are we not now in the most invidious of positions in that we have to hope that the experts that we have been told we should rely on for the last, since the start of this crisis, we've got to hope that those experts are wrong and that you and your colleagues in government are right, you with no expertise are right, and that the people with the expertise in public health are wrong, and that's where we've been left.
I think we're definitely at a very critical position, and everyone agrees with that, both government and NPHET. And just in relation to what happened at the weekend, I think there's always a balance trying to be struck here between public health and, I suppose, keeping the economy and society running, and those issues as well that Michael has made reference to, elective procedures, non-COVID related issues. Because if there is a surge and the numbers do go up, it's going, in order to create the capacity within our hospitals, we'll have to start deferring other elective procedures in order to deal with the virus. So the message is the same, and people are tired listening to it. But if we want to bring down the numbers, if we want to get people back to work, we have to adhere to all the protocols, wearing a mask, keeping your social distance, washing your hands, minimising your social contacts. And that's the real message that we need to get out.
Can
now,
I get you though,
rather than any other kind of distractions, because we are this week, the next 2-3 weeks is absolutely critical, and we all have the power in our own hands in relation to bringing down this virus.
I agree with that.
But who do we trust, Hildegard Nocton, now in terms of where we should be in terms of, and how we should be modifying our behaviour? Because
I think we're all, when you say who we trust, I presume you're saying is a government or NPHET. It's not one or the other. We are all, I can tell you, working together. And I think the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach have been very clear that they are working. It's all for I suppose, Ireland and suppressing this virus. It's not one against the other. We're all trying to make the best decisions in a very, very uncertain. If we had a crystal ball, it would be absolutely fantastic, but we don't. So we have to make the best decision for society, for mental health, for ensuring that we have capacity within our hospitals. If we do have to shut down, for example, that we have time to put in place the pandemic unemployment, the payments, the social welfare payments. You can't just do that overnight. We need time. And we're ready if that needs to happen, but we don't want to go there. We have a chance now. We have time. And individually, every citizen listening to this radio programme this afternoon, we all have a chance to bring down this virus, and we can have our restaurants opened again and our shops and retail. It is, we do have a window of opportunity to do that now.
I want to bring in Professor Alan Irvine, President of the Irish Hospital Consultants Association, and you hot-footed it here today, Alan, and we appreciate it, from your own annual conference, which of course had to be virtual this year. But you were there today discussing the 840,000 people that are waiting for care in the health system, and all those concerns around capacity in the health service. Can I ask you, as you sit here today, are you nervous about ICU and acute hospital bed capacity as we face into the winter?
Look, I think the truth is our members are nervous. They're pretty tired, pretty exhausted. It's been a long 7 months trying to recalibrate everything that's done with the COVID response and with non-COVID care as well, as has been highlighted, to try and get people who have time-sensitive surgeries, time-sensitive appointments. And we came into this, and I think this is important just to emphasise, we came into this hamstrung somewhat in that our acute capacity and our ICU capacity, as Michael's already mentioned, we were running at about 250, whereas we should have been running at about 580, 590 from 10 years back. That's one side of the capacity issue. And the other side of the capacity issue is how well resourced are our public health teams to switch off outbreaks, clusters, actively manage those outbreaks. And the truth is, we're at a point where, in European terms, we're low on both of those numbers. So everything gets squeezed in the middle. And the third variable, of course, is in human behaviour. The virus spreads by contact between people. So in Ireland, we came into this, we're part of Europe. We have a liberal country, we're a liberal democracy. We like our freedoms. So it's a wicked problem. And there is no easy solution. You know, herd immunity is not a solution. I don't believe, for various reasons, that currently zero COVID is remotely possible, and that comes down to all kinds of historic, geographic, legal, cultural issues in the north and with the UK that are not easily solved. So I think it's a wicked problem, and we have to dance around it and do our absolute best. But I know our members are seeing the cases turning up in ICU. There's over 30. We know from looking at Philip Nolan's modelling that there is an inevitability to this. It's a mathematical progression that
I looked at those numbers today, the mathematical just progression really jumps out of you, because 4 weeks ago there was 52 cases in hospital. Yeah. 2 weeks ago there was 102 cases in hospital. This morning there's 194. So we're seeing a doubling over every 2 weeks. So and we can see where that might go if that trajectory kept up.
Yeah, there's no doubt about this. And those of us who've been closely looking at these figures have seen this in July, believe it or not. But in July, everybody come through a really rough spring and summer, and people didn't want to necessarily believe that this was going to happen again. But unfortunately, the facts are stubborn. The cases are there, and we will see them. They will displace people out of our intensive care units because people with COVID need the care, but other people need that care too, with major operations, trauma and so on. So we're going to face a very difficult winter, no matter what way we do.
Now, do we have enough ICU beds to take us through this winter?
No, we don't. Very simply, we don't. Now, what we did during
so who drops off the back of the lorry first, if I can put it that way, in terms of like who gets shunted out of
sure.
critical care first those COVID cases start coming in the door?
So it doesn't quite work exactly. Like, people don't get shunted out of critical care.
Or who doesn't have their elective surgery.
Yeah, yeah, so that would be incredibly cruel. But anybody who is due to have elective surgery, what first of all happens is a flexing system. So other areas around the hospital will get identified as where short-term intensive care type delivery. And it's not really truly intensive care, but it's flexed up. So operating theatres, other wards will be converted. And this is what happened. And we flexed up to north of 350 beds in the early spring surge. And there's a likelihood that, and the HSE has a surge capacity built in, but that then displaces planned. So if you have a surgery that you know will need 2 days in intensive care, major abdominal, major thoracic, major neurosurgery, that surgery then will not be able to happen because those beds are full. Now, I don't want people listening to be anxious either. You know, there are contingencies put in, but it displaces the priority of care right down. And then we see another bulge in waiting lists for planned care, for outpatient appointments, again, coming on the back of very long waiting lists that were already there in February.
Is there something we can do now to, better cope over the next number of months?
Well, everybody can do the simple things.
Well, apart from what we've already discussed, but in terms of bed capacity and ICU capacity.
So we can. You know, there is a winter plan. There will be a budget on Tuesday, which will clarify where the funding lines come for all of what is in the winter plan and how exactly that will be played out. And we're anxious to see that. There's 800 beds from last year's winter plan, which look like they will be maintained, and we want to keep those. And there's potentially another 590 beds of various types. And we think in the winter plan, the request from the HSE is to get to 300 proper ICU beds. And Paul Reid addressed us this morning. He's keen that those 300 beds remain in the base capacity of the ICU. And of course, we completely support that. And we want to get to 450 and closer to the 580 that we really need as soon as possible. Paul Reid's vision is 450 by 2022. And again, there'd be a lot of support around him in getting the funding to do that.
Okay, I want to go to Pierce and bring you in, Pierce Doherty up there in Donegal. You're obviously very close to the coal face of this crisis and at the border there. What is the feeling up there today in terms of what can be done to deal with what's happening both in Donegal and over in Derry?
Yeah, I think the feeling's quite anxious. People are seeing the rates increase here in Donegal. They're seeing them increase across the border. I was looking at some of the numbers today, and there's a very clear pattern here. The numbers are getting worse in Donegal, in most parts of Donegal. 2 weeks ago, we had electoral areas that had no COVID cases. Today, the incident rates are over 350 per 100,000. And what we're seeing in Donegal, unfortunately, we're seeing in most parts then of the rest of the state starting to creep up as well. And we see it across the border. So there's no doubt that there's huge concern. There is a lot that we can do ourselves individually. I echo the points that have been made by Minister Nocton. We do need to follow public health guidance, but I have no doubt that there's other interventions that will be required also to try and suppress this virus, because where I probably disagree with Michael McDowell, the whole point of this to try and suppress the virus, and the four restrictions to make sure that our health service isn't overrun, to make sure that we can do what we didn't do at the start of this pandemic, which is to make sure elective surgery can continue along with COVID-related care. And the pathway of this virus is very clear. You've mentioned the figures there today from, you know, it's doubling every 2 weeks in terms of hospitalisations. The number of people admitted to ICU in the last 24 hours is deeply worrying as well in relation to the beds. So, you know, we do need to see interventions.
But in terms of the border issue that you have to deal with, and it's obviously a huge issue because of the case numbers across the border in Derry and Stranraer in particular. I mean, do we need to consider? I mean, I'm old enough to remember the foot and mouth crisis and the massive Garda presence that we deployed up around the border. Do we need to consider severely restricting movement as much as we could across that border now?
I think an over-focus on the border isn't helpful. This is a region that is deeply, that the virus has got a hold in it in a very rapid way. If you look at, for example, Derry, 1 month ago, the incidence rates was 10 per 100,000. Today it's over 1,000 per 100,000. As I said, in Donegal, it's in some places over 600 per 100,000. And it's not just about crossing the border. And indeed, in the north, there's different low rates and some very high rates. It is very clear the public health advice is you should not leave your county boundary for non-essential travel. It shouldn't be happening. It doesn't matter whether it's to Derry or Tyrone or whether it's to Sligo or Leitrim. And that's the advice all right throughout the state in terms of the advice in the north. It's similar. You should not be leaving your own home for non-essential travel. That's the advice that's been there for quite some time. So we do need to re-emphasise that advice.
Do we need to greater police it? And we will go on later in the programme to talk about...
There are checkpoints. There are checkpoints. There are Gardaí that are out on the roads and have been since the intervention here in Donegal 2 weeks ago. It's not just in relation to crossings to Derry or Tyrone, but also crossings into Leitrim. There are people there that are, the Gardaí are there, they're stopping people, they're asking them where they're going, and they're re-emphasising the advice that is there, and I think that's the right approach. But look, I think this screams loud that we need an all-Ireland approach. I think the time for talking about this, and we've talked about this up and down for the last number of months.
But from what we heard this week, Piers Doherty, that seems to be further away than ever after the conversations that we've heard of, the contact that was between Micheál Martin and Boris Johnson this week.
Well, first of all, I welcome the fact that Micheál Martin lifted the phone to Boris Johnson. We have been very much engaged at an executive level, Michelle O'Neill and Conor Murphy, to try and ensure that the resources were there in the executive to deal with any further restrictions that are warranted.
They're not there though, are they?
Well, there has been a bit of movement in that in relation to an announcement yesterday in terms of additional resources and a wage subsidy scheme. So this does allow for consideration now. Conor Murphy, as Finance Minister, has been engaged directly with the Chancellor, Michelle O'Neill, Arlene Foster. All the parties have been on the same hymn sheet in relation to this, in fairness to them, and welcome the intervention by Micheál Martin.
So are we looking at the possibility then of the North going into a level 3 type restriction regime?
I think there is a need, and I think that's clear from political leaders, that there is a need for further intervention. I'm sure that the executive will be meeting early next week and will have that considered. But I want to go back to my key point. While we've seen interventions in relation to the resources, the financial resources, what we need is greater intervention in relation to the disease itself, to this virus. And that means very close interaction between the health ministers, north and south, not at a superficial level, but at a real level. Decisions being taken on an all-Ireland basis. We can't have the anomalies where you have one set of restrictions on one side of the border and a different set of restrictions on the other side of the border, because for people living in these communities, the border is not a reality to us. You know, it's you know, our families are on either side, our workplaces are on either side, and so on and so forth. So there needs to be joined up decisions. We haven't got there, but I think the incidents over the last number of days is screaming loudly that we now need to move rhetoric into action.
Yeah, Alan Irvine, you're familiar with the North, obviously.
Yeah, I'm from Fermanagh, so I grew up in a border county, and the you know, the border is a sort of something I understand, like Pierce would, at a visceral kind of level, but it's a political issue. What we need to do is depoliticise it and focus on public health and not allow the border to get in the way and not allow identity issues, identity politics to get in the way. So I think The level three regime that we have, where people don't leave their county, that is actually an extremely useful way of taking some of the heat out of the border issue. Because if you stay in your county in the north, then you're by definition not crossing the border. But it makes the border a secondary issue to the county border. And I think that might be the way that we get a bit more acceptance around, because there are communities in the north who will view the border in very different ways, and that will impede the public health message.
Hildegard, can I put something to you? Because I know this is a question that a huge number of people will be hanging on the answer to. Kite that was flown yesterday in relation to the possibility of a 2 or 3 week midterm break for schools this coming up at the end of the month. Do you know anything more about that? Can you give us any clarity at all as to the thinking behind that?
Well, I wasn't at the Cabinet subcommittee yesterday, but it's my understanding that it wasn't up for discussion, but and no decision has been made in relation to extending the school's midterm breaks. But I suppose what we can say is everything has been watched very closely now. And I think that's, and even looking at international figures and evidence abroad in relation to schools and infection rates. So I would say, like everything else, it's a moving target. This virus is moving really fast. It's often moving faster than us. So I think that's,
yeah, I think that's the current position. I think don't people deserve as much notice as humanly possible. I mean, I think there was a lot of criticism from students, and I think, you know, justified in many cases, that they were only told the day they were packing their bags to go to college, they were told that actually all third level courses will have to be delivered remotely, landing people with huge, you know, headaches, as it would be if you were, you know, a single working parent, or if you have two people working in a house to try and sort out childcare for those weeks. Could we give, you know, is it fair to fly the kite if you're not going to give any clarity as to what your thinking is on it?
Yeah, I can understand people need that timeline, that time frame. But what I can say is no decision has been made on it. And I can't say, I'm like, NPHET will be guiding us hugely in relation to that. But so there is no plans at the moment. So that's what I can say. But I agree that people do need time for this. But it's important to say that the schools have done a really, really good job. And that has been acknowledged in relation to the protocols. And they've proved to be, you know, very safe environments. There has been testing taking place.
Can I just come?
Yeah, that's Sam. Yeah, I was just going to go
Pierce.
To you.
It was Pierce. Oh, Pierce. Yeah, sorry. No, I just want to make the point, because look, this idea, this may be worth considering. There's no doubt about it. Everything should be on the table. But what needs to happen is not the kite flying that we had, but actually engagement with the sectors, with the unions, with the education partners. I had this conversation with my own wife. She's a school teacher this morning, and kind of asking, look, do you think it'll be a week up before the October break, or a week after the October break? They're trying to figure out how they will provide online tutoring to children in areas which don't have online or remote access to the internet. And these are things like, and you know, we can't answer those questions because we don't know. This is just a kite. Look, this is an idea that may be worth considering, but it needs to be considered in a measured way. So let's engage with the unions, let's engage with the education partners, and let's not do this where we just pull this out of the air, and because it causes anxiety to pupils, to parents, and to teachers as well.
And that will happen. The engagement with stakeholders, of course, will happen, and that online. But as I say, it's important to say no decision has been made.
But I think a circular went out yesterday to say
it probably is a kite been flown, and there's no point jumping to conclusions on a decision that hasn't been made. But there will be engagement, and I think that's something that government is very conscious of in all sectors, that you prepare sectors for as best we can in a very uncertain pandemic.
Indeed. Pierce, did you say a circular went out
yesterday? Yeah, I mean, look, my understanding, I could be wrong, is that there was a circular from the Department of Education actually asking schools to prepare plans for online learning. Maybe the minister may be able to clarify that or not. But there is a time frame here, because obviously the midterm break is coming up, and if it is to happen a week before, then there is very little time for actually that type of engagement. And people need to know what is expected. Is it remote learning? Is it an extension of the break? Is it online learning the way it was in April and through those months? And that's why I think, you know, look, government, whatever about the final decision, there needs to be a plan here, because all of these things have to be on the table, and we need to have plans, and those plans are best done when there's proper engagement.
Minister, can you add any clarity to that? Do you know know about the circular?
I'm not in the Department of Education, but what I can say is it's important not to start creating fear out there and panic and anxiety. And we have to have trust and faith in our excellent teachers who did a fantastic job throughout this pandemic in very uncertain times and had to go online and do a lot of their learnings for the first time. And they did an absolutely fantastic job. And it is not easy. I acknowledge that. I come from a teaching profession myself. But you can be assured that there will be dialogue with the stakeholders. And again, this is all speculation, and it's important to say that you can be assured that the Minister for Education will be and is always engaging with stakeholders in relation to any decision. But no decision has been made, and it's very clear to say that.
No decision has been made. That's very clear. I just want to bring Sam in because I want to know, what is the latest? Are we quite clear that the levels of transmission in children in the school going cohort hasn't increased since they returned to school? Should we be considering school closure as part of any kind of lockdown or circuit break plan?
I think the schools have done exceptionally well. We've seen very small number of what are called outbreaks, but they may have actually been acquired by the children outside of school. So I think certainly those under 12, under 14, it has been a very successful back to school, and the kids are loving it and are learning loads. The older children, thankfully, have been largely very cooperative with the restrictions. And again, so far, the sort of 14 to 24-year-olds, we haven't seen much there. Thanks for bringing me in, Katie. If I could add a little bit, I agree with what's been said about the health service and the need for cancer care and stroke care, public health strengthening, and the issue about our damage to the economy of higher restrictions. But unfortunately, what I have to say is we've got to consider what's the counterfactual. If we continue on level three, what will happen? The levels in Dublin rates have plateaued. In 2 to 3 weeks, we'll see the rates plateau in other counties, and that's going to end up, you know, at maybe 800 or 1,000 cases a day. That's not a sustainable place that we can sit at for many, many months. It's not a sustainable meal plan. So I think we need diplomatic links to, you know, Edinburgh, to London, to Wales, to Northern Ireland, to be trying to negotiate with them, to use that sort of, you know, we all saw English nationalism, shockingly, 3 years ago rising. They're quite comfortable with border controls. And that's what we're asking, is some sort of internal controls of travel between the different parts of the UK and from people outside of UK into UK and Ireland.
Okay.
Then perhaps we can get a bubble like Australia, New Zealand. They've got two countries, you know, 30 million people happily COVID-free. 1.5 billion people in the world are living in a COVID-free world. And I would like our country to be in that COVID-free part, not in the COVID-transmitting one.
Okay, I just want to give people, because I did ask people to give us their views on this. In terms of yes to level five now, says Mary and Kerry, if we can get to meet our families at Christmas. Senator McDowell has just shone a light on the inadequacy of the public health system due to the lack of state investment over the past 40 years. He would do well to acknowledge his own political involvement therein, says Ed in Selbridge. We need to be very careful about opening up for Christmas, says another texter. We have seen what opening up for communions, confirmations and matches got us. If we open for Christmas, we'll be locked down again in January. Better to open slowly in January. And then Level 3 Plus is working in Dublin. This is from Luke Martin on Twitter. Level 3 Plus is working in Dublin. A jump to Level 5 would cost 450,000 jobs and a significant reduction in non-COVID HSE service, and that would result in deaths. A balance needs to be struck.
Can I just say there, I accept the criticism that our health service has not been great, but we have the OECD says that we are spending more than any other country per head in Europe on health, and we have these problems. So it's not just a resource issue. And the second thing I just want to say
we could argue that point about our spend in the health service in terms of where are we spending it in the right place. But I just want to go back very quickly to the issue of schools, because the schools opening was largely successful, and it is mostly down to the incredible efforts of staff and schools and their secretaries and all of those people. But I think that we could still do a lot of work in terms of optimising that, because I know that there's a lot of concern amongst staff around the fact that they're not considered close contacts when there is a COVID positive, and particularly for special needs assistants who would be, you know, leaning over children in close contact. Any primary school student teacher is, you know, opening sandwiches and leaning over children, and we're not necessarily doing the right testing or regular testing that we could be doing to ensure that we keep the levels down.
Okay, and there we will take a break.
Tweet at Saturday RTE.
Now, last night, the Cabinet COVID-19 Subcommittee agreed to introduce graduated fines for non-compliance with COVID-19 restrictions. This follows the recommencement of Operation Fanacht to discourage people from making unnecessary journeys across county borders. Hildegard Nocton, do we know yet what sort of shape this new regime is going to take. I know that Leo Varadkar said at your parliamentary party meeting this week that we could be looking at a €50 fine for not wearing a mask and perhaps €200 for leaving, you know, crossing a county border.
Yeah, my understanding is so from the cabinet committee yesterday, so they have agreed to examine the introduction of tiered fines. And as you say, like at the moment, there's already legislation in place that sees fines of up to €2,500 or up to 6 months in prison. That's in line with the 1947 Act, but obviously that's not appropriate for all offences.
Well, it's not. Just in relation to that, Minister, we asked the Garda press officer for the numbers who have been prosecuted under that legislation, because of course that involves prosecution. It's not an on-the-spot fine system. They said that on Garda Síochána has forwarded a number of files to the DPP. That's as much information as we're getting there. But it doesn't sound like that we're talking about a big cohort of people there.
Yes, and I know the Gardaí, and rightly so, police by consent, and they want to encourage people and engage with people, and that's what they do really well. And the Irish people really responded throughout, you know, the earlier part of this pandemic. But I think there's a fear where we're reaching a phase now where there may be, it might be a minority of people who don't want to adhere to the government regulations. So I think we do have to consider these the introduction of these fines and make sure that it's done in an appropriate way, an appropriate fine for an appropriate offence. We don't want to do this. I don't want to go down this line. But if you know, for public health, in order to protect people, we may have to do that.
Okay.
I would prefer if we didn't.
Michael McDougall.
Well, I think this is very important that we concentrate on what's practical. I mean, the Fanacht roadblocks ended up with healthcare workers being stuck for an hour on motorways, and people bringing their kids to school, and people coming back from school, and people going to collect their kids, and people bringing people to dental appointments, and people going to work. I mean, that is not the way for an Garda Síochána to operate. It's a big, big mistake for them to deliberately create traffic jams. If you're going to,
that was all they were left with, though, wasn't it? Sorry, because they have no powers as of now until this new regime
but
is introduced.
It wasn't a clever idea, and it backfired in my view. But
would it have put people off going on unnecessary journeys?
But I mean, what kind of people do get onto the motorway for an unnecessary purpose? I mean, what I don't know what kind of people we're dealing with. Most people in those traffic jams were trying to get to work.
That traffic did reduce as a result operation.
Of course traffic reduced, because, I mean, anybody who said, God almighty, I have a good reason, I'll get to work and I'll just bring up my boss and say, I can't get in because the N7 is choked. But can I make a different point about fining people? I think it is necessary in certain circumstances. For instance, if we're going to say that everyone must wear a mask, I think it is a good idea to say that there should be some consequence if you just blithely ignore all that. But fines, you know, are criminal procedures, and it's very easy to say on-the-spot fines and have guards going around with notebooks handing out traffic ticket-type documents to people. But getting that money in, say, from youngsters or students and or all the rest of it is a totally different thing. And if they all go to court, the court system can't take mass enforcement in the same way that it used to with road traffic matters. So, I mean, I think we have to be practical about this. The big thing is to persuade people to obey the law, but the law must be reasonable. I mean, if you live in Rathmichael in South Dublin, just near Shankill, if you go to do your shopping in Bray, you're going across a county boundary. You know, so there are absurdities to all of this. And if people are going to start handing out tickets to people who go from Shankill to Bray rather than Shankill to Dunleary, you know, somebody has to be reasonable about all of this.
Nessa.
Well, look, I suppose to Michael's point, first of all, about 30% of journeys in cars in Europe are leisure, and 20% more are shopping. So shopping local wouldn't be the worst thing in the world and be very good for business. I think to the more substantive point, I'm not a huge fan of fining people, I have to be honest. And I don't particularly like, you know, fines and sin taxes. However, I do think we have something kind of precious in this country, in that the Garda Síochána are, in fact, that, you know, they're the keepers of the peace.
Yeah.
And that's something that other countries don't necessarily necessarily have. You see much more kind of robust policing in places like France, and they don't have the good kind of community policing sense that we have here. And it's something that we should try and hold on to. So I think what
does this jeopardise that, do you think?
Well, look, I think what I am hearing is really intense frustration from some people who are following the rules and then seeing others within their community not following them. And we do need to do something about that. And in the great scheme of things, I would prefer on balance fines over detaining people or prosecuting them. So if we need to do something more, I would prefer that than giving legislating for more serious powers to the Gardaí, who I don't feel actually, you know, would prefer that themselves. I think they're quite proud of their you know, keepers of the peace.
What did you think of Operation Fionnacht? Did you think that was a reasonable approach by the Gardaí under the circumstances?
I think ultimately Hildegard has the right of us that, you know, we have to do this by consent, and there has to be trust between the guards and the government. And so Operation Fionnacht is more about a feeling that you might be asked, you might be stopped, but it won't.
But isn't it also about people sitting in their cars trying to go about their business, being absolutely enraged that they are being held up for no reason because they've been largely waved through by the time they got to the checkpoint? Did that not sour relations between the citizenry and on guard the Sí Chéanna?
I think people are more enraged when they see the COVID numbers going up and up and up and then seeing some people flouting the rules. And I think we're all, you know, very aware that we're quite likely to lose loved ones this winter. And it's very serious, and we need to take, you know, action and public action as a group, as a group of people, as communities. We need to take action. And that is by consent. And that is, you know, something that we all need to work together towards. And I think people are willing to do that. And there might be frustration in your daily life, but in general terms, we're all going to work together to try and deal with this.
Is there an issue, Piers, is there an issue in relation to like €200 for one person or one family is a completely different matter than it is for another family, and in terms of, you know, ability to pay and who might get the brunt of this?
Yeah, no, I think right across the board there's absolutely huge upset and frustration when they see people breaking the rules, especially, you know, for those who've made huge sacrifices, those who have loved ones who may be high risk. But we have to be very cautious when we start looking at fines. It can actually undermine what we're planning to do. So I think that we need to look at this carefully in terms of how effective it would be. It needs to be done in consultation with the Gardaí, and we need to make sure that we don't introduce something that actually would undermine or just be difficult to enforce. We have a situation in terms of Operation Fionnacht. We're hearing a lot of criticism for people, some of them who are essential workers, people who are trying to get to work to hospitals. This is something I raised way back with the former Taoiseach Leo Varadkar when we had some of the congestions in the motorways back around the Easter time, where, you know, there was frustration there where people who were essential workers were held up on traffic jams, sometimes up to about an hour long, only to be waved through then by the Gardaí. So we need to approach the enforcement very, very carefully. But we also need to, you know, there is organised breaking of the rules happening here, and that needs to be dealt with. So I just think it needs to be done in a cautious way and in a way that doesn't actually end up undermining what we're trying to do. And I think one of the key things is people want to follow the guidelines. People want to suppress this virus. People need to be given very, very clear advice. Some of that still isn't clear, you know, when you go to the debate about face masks versus visors, or indeed how to appropriately wear the face mask. You know, there's a lot more that we can do, I think, together as well to help people fulfil the public health advice.
Okay, I'm going to move on, because on Tuesday, of course, we are expecting the largest budget in the history of the state. We're hearing there'll be no increase in income tax or USC, no expectation really now that the PUP levels that were cut will be restored in this budget, but there may be some tweaks, and that the employment wage subsidy scheme is likely to be extended beyond next March. And today there's speculation that the living alone allowance and fuel allowances will be increased. And that is because of the one thing we don't have to speculate about, which is the increase in the carbon taxes, which we know is going up by £7.50 a tonne. Minister, can I ask you, is it a bad time to be hitting households and businesses with extra fuel charges and energy costs?
Well, the carbon budget, the carbon tax, sorry, was agreed. First of all, it was agreed through an all-party Oireachtas committee, and then through the Programme for Government, it was set at €100 by the year 2030. So we're increasing it incrementally. But as part of that, we are putting in place measures to ensure that we're supporting families and sectors who will find that transition hardest. So over that 10-year period, it's projected that the revenue from the carbon tax will be 9.5 billion and 3 billion of that will go towards social welfare supports. You'll have 5 billion of the carbon tax that will be ring fenced going towards retrofitting. And also, for example, 1.5 billion of that will go towards a new REP scheme for farmers. So it's not going to be punitive. What we're trying to do is encourage people to make the switch and at the same time protect those sectors who are going to find it hardest, those who are facing fuel poverty. And that is going to be a really key focus in relation to this transition to a low carbon economy, ensuring that we're protecting the most vulnerable and those who are going to find it hardest to make that switch.
Yeah, if I can ask you about that, Nessa Horgan, I know that in the negotiations for government, you were very concerned about this exact point. You didn't like the model that was being introduced. It was the Fine Gael model, not the model that had been preferred by the Green Party. And you were concerned that a lot of more vulnerable people would not be protected.
Yeah, it is well rehearsed that I objected to this, and ultimately it was taken out of my hands in the negotiations and agreed by the three leaders. I do have concerns. I think that there is a possibility to mitigate for low-income families the worst of the carbon tax, and I'm hoping that that will be done in this budget. That does mean things like increasing the fuel allowance, increasing the living alone allowance, and pushing it through, you know, social welfare. I think, though, there's another
aspect
to it.
Just in relation to that, because I wasn't clear to me reading the accounts of that this morning, will everybody benefit from that? Will there be some low-income families that are not going to be caught in the...
Well, as a backbencher, I haven't seen the scheme yet, and that remains to be seen what conduits of social welfare. There are many ways of accessing social welfare, from unemployment benefit to child benefit. And so until we see the actual scheme, I'm not aware of what aspects of what social welfare will be increased. But there is another aspect to it. And just to say, on the issue of retrofit, it would be really important that we start those programmes of retrofit with social housing. But there is another aspect to it, which is around basic services. Now, one of the ways to ensure that we reduce income and social inequality is to ensure that we fully fund basic services. And I think for this budget, considering the winter plan of 600 million, which largely forgot disability services and forgot mental health, if we don't have disability funding and if we don't have significant funding for mental health, then it will be very hard to say that this is a successful budget.
Can I put that to you, Minister? I'll go to you, Pearce, in a moment, but I want to put that to the Minister, because I think a lot of people were quite shocked when that winter plan emerged with not a mention of mental health in it, given what we know about you know, the stresses and the anxiety and the mental health issues that the current situation has contributed to.
The winter plan was just that. It was a winter plan in relation to bed capacity, ensuring that our hospitals can cope. As part of the budget process, that's where the supports in relation to mental health and all the other services will be. So next Tuesday, there will be a budget for that. So it wouldn't have been part of the winter plan. It would be as part of the budgetary process. So there'll be more clarity around that on Tuesday.
Okay. Pearce.
Yeah, look, this budget needs to show real ambition. It needs to invest in capacity, both in housing and affordable and cost rental. That's why we're suggesting that there has to be 20,000 housing units delivered in 2021. It also needs to invest in capacity in our health service. You know, the 1,100 beds that we need, the 100 extra ICU beds. But it can do other things as well. It can reduce the cost of living on people. It can deal with the issue of rent freezes and reducing rents. It can deal with the cost of childcare, which we are proposing a model which would, over 2 years, reduce the cost of childcare by 2/3. And really, this is the time where we need to be ambitious. We need to invest in the economy. We need to support jobs. And that's where I'm very concerned about what I'm hearing from government, is the necessary supports won't be there to make sure that people who may lose their jobs because of future restrictions, have that certainty that the job will be there. So we need additional grants. We need a proper voucher scheme for the hospitality sector. The likes that we've proposed, €200 per adult, €100 per child. We need to reduce VAT in that sector, and we need to stimulate demand by a big injection in terms of capital, along with many other things. And I agree with Nyas 100%. A lot of this will be measured on how we deal with those who are most vulnerable in a society. Is there going to be an appropriate package for the disability sector, for mental health? Are we going to actually, for the first time, put those front and centre in this budget? And that's what I argue very, very strongly needs to be done.
And in relation, apart from borrowing, which I know we are huge, borrowing very, very heavily for this budget, where would the revenue raising come for some of these undoubtedly laudable ambitions? I mean, you're talking about wealth taxes and taxes on everyone earning over 100,000 and increases in corporation tax.
Yeah, well, most of it does come, as you said, Katie, from borrowing. So you'd have a deficit to GDP of less than 6%. That would be less than France, and unless what we've heard from the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council than what the rest of Europe is doing, it would also reduce the deficit from what is in 2020. So it's the right track. Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, indeed the IMF, are saying countries need to borrow and need to stimulate their economy. But yes, there are a number of taxation measures that we would have. Our guarantee is nobody earning below 100,000 euro would pay any additional income tax. We wouldn't have the carbon tax because we believe, as has been discussed, it is regressive in the form that it's been planned. We haven't got the investment for the alternatives. So we would see, for example, taxes closing loopholes, for example, that was argued by Seamus Coffey, that in terms of intangible assets that were onshored here that can still write off their taxes, write off their profits against assets that were onshored. And that loophole could be closed, should be closed. That itself would bring in €750 million. And if there was ever a time when we needed loopholes of that nature to be closed, it is now, because we very much need that money now to pump in to do things like restore the pandemic unemployment payment to the original level of 350 and to make sure that there's a proper employer wage subsidy scheme that people can
retain jobs.
Can I get
in there, Katie?
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll let you in a moment, Minister, because Michael McDougall is just
one thing that does occur to me, you know. There won't be houses built, Ed, or 21,000 houses built next year if we're at level five, because every building site will be closed. There won't be a lot of things happening if we go to level five. So people have to remember what NPHET was actually proposing. It was a close down of the economy. And the big point that I want to reiterate here is, why would things...
They weren't closing down the economy forever.
They were proposing to close down the economy for a month or three weeks. But how will things be better in 3 weeks' time? I mean, what would have changed in 3 weeks' time to make the economy?
The numbers would be lower.
Yeah, but they go back up again. I mean, there is no this plan to close down the economy temporarily is based on the proposition somehow that things will suddenly improve in mid-November, and what's causing the high community infection rate will have disappeared. There's no reason to believe that's going to happen.
But what I'm missing from your proposition is what happens if the numbers spiral out of control. What do we do then?
I agree with all the other contributors. We have to emphasise the hand washing, the distance keeping.
We've been emphasising that since last March, and we are where we are.
We haven't really, because things were good in the summer, and when the schools reopened and the students went back to universities,
but they were good in the summer after lockdown.
But after lockdown had been eased, they were good. Yes, but we can't have another lockdown. I mean, those people in that factory in West Dublin cannot afford to lose their jobs, and nobody waving any amount of checks at them is going to get their jobs.
But then you're putting
back
jobs above people's lives. What you're saying.
Well, Nasa, the sad fact is that the WHO says that public health involves the economic well-being of the people as well.
Well, look, the Greens are very... We're very fond of saying there's no jobs on a dead planet, but there's also no economy in the middle of a pandemic that's running wild.
Sorry, that's why there has to be a balanced approach to it, and that's why we can't go to level five and close every factory. We just can't do it.
Okay, can I just ask you, Hildegard, one last thing? The European green light system for traffic light system for transport, for travel, airline travel. Are we going to adopt that? Are we going to have a situation where we will allow people in if they can produce a negative COVID test and introduce COVID tests for exiting the country?
So the government has agreed that we're going to broadly align with that European approach. That's a red light, orange light and a green light system. And the European Council is meeting on the 13th of October next week. So we're working, that's the Department of Health, at a cross government basis, transport, in relation to a testing regime that will be workable and a regime that is not going to compromise our public health testing regime here in Ireland.
So that is still on the cards?
It is, but it's complex, and the testing capacity is an issue.
Okay.
The PCR test is what's been used by the Department of Health here and across the world. It's seen as the gold standard, and we need to ensure that it is a testing regime that doesn't, as I say, compromise what we're doing here, but also there's not going to be delays at our airports and that we're able to work with other European countries.
Okay, Minister, I'm going to have to stop you there because we are well over time now. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the rest of your weekend safely.
Saturday with Katie Hannan. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player app.
Saturday with Katie Hannan was produced by Mary O'Hagan. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon. Research was by Andrew Fleming. And on sound today, Mark Dwyer.